Okay, so we apologize for this request to present at the last minute, but we thought that we'd take the opportunity to present to the committee our role in this new regulatory framework as a supervisory body, and to also to express some of our responses to some of the issues that have been raised as stakeholders. I'm Raksha Senarai. I'm from the Legal Services Department of the South African Reserve Bank. I'm joined by Lyle Horsley, who's also from the Legal Services Department, and Stephen Makunazi and Abigail Marsman from our Banking Supervision Division of the Reserve Bank, who do a lot of the supervisory oversight for the banks. So the presentation will be done by my colleagues and all answer questions that are raised. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dr. Good afternoon, Chair, and to everybody. As it was, my name is Stephen. So what we'd like to do within the next couple of minutes, just to give you a quick background of what we do. I think it's very important because it is the context of how we regulate this amendment being called going forward and the mechanism that we're going to be using. As for background, within the Reserve Bank, we have three supervisory bodies in terms of the FIC Act, RAT. Although that might change going forward, but we currently have three supervisory bodies, which are departments. One is the Financial Surveillance Department, that deals with cross-border transactions. And we've got National Payment Systems, and we've got us as a bank supervisor, who's responsible for regulating banks. But that, as you mentioned earlier on, we've got the SSRB that is on its way, that meaning that will also change, and we might also be looking after the insurance in terms of the AML safety. In terms of the current legislation, we are mandated to be a supervisor of banks and all other issues that I've mentioned. But I just want to give you a picture how we go about, doing it, so that it will give context when it comes to the implementation, the issue of traditional, phase that we were discussing earlier this morning. We do currently, as a bank, utilize a risk-based approach. So we, in the absence of national risk assessment, in the absence of a sectoral risk assessment, we have good mechanism to be able to assess risk before we visit institutions like for inspections, or we engage with institutions. For example, we do visit five of our largest banks three times a year, and we spend a day with them. It's because we've recognized that most of our transactions are happening there, and the largest exposure is also there. So we recognize that in terms of our framework. But we conduct on-site inspections, as alluded earlier on, that there's a constitutional order on that one, but we conduct routine inspections that are not affected by the constitutional court order. On-site inspections. Those are routine inspections, not analysis. So basically, routine inspections are the ones that we will plan based on our risk framework. But the ones that are problematic are the ones that are non-routine, where we... Yeah, off-site is in the office. On-site, we are on, or we are in the district. Yeah. So off-site, I was still talking about the inspections. So we conduct those two, and that's how we've conducted about 33 of those inspections. We conduct inspections in country, we conduct inspections in foreign jurisdictions, like our banks have operations in foreign jurisdictions. We have visited about three countries, I think in Kenya, Uganda, Malawi. We've conducted inspections, we spend about a week there. So we also do offsite supervision. Offsite supervision is based on desktop reviews. So that's just to give context of what we do, and we continue to do it. We'll just do minor changes in our operations going forward in terms of making sure that the thing is implemented. I'll give it to my colleague, Abigail.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the time afforded to the South African Reserve Bank. Good afternoon to all members and attendees to the session. We thought it might just be useful to uplift some of the critical comments that FAB has made on the board to Treasury in our submissions. We've had a series of quite extensive discussions between ourselves and Treasury to resolve the majority of the issues that have emanated from within FAB on the board. But just in terms of some of the provisions which have been alluded to by other stakeholders and other representatives in the committee hearing today, we thought it's important that we put forward some remarks from a supervisory perspective as well. In terms of the very contentious provision in the bill at the moment related to PIPs, the current arrangement or current requirements imposed on the banking sector at the moment, which have emanated both from guidance notes issued by the FIC that are currently in force and expected to be complied with at this point in time, as well as in terms of the FATF recommendations which we expect our banks to be subscribing to, banks already are expected to comply with requirements and identification and due diligence mechanisms related to PIPs. So what in the bill at the moment as a provision is an extended version of the known definition of PIPs and the FATF definition of PIPs, and the extensions to that understandable internationally accepted definition of PIPs are those requirements related to the requirement to identify a company that provides goods or services to an organ or state. We put on the record that the ability for institutions to be able to be in a position to identify individuals or entities falling within the latter part of that definition could be problematic, but we do hear the remarks on the points made in the discussion today that there is possible arrangement that can be put in place to have a transitional or phased in approach where the latter part of that be brought into effect at a future point in time when the mechanisms are available. Within the current definition of PIPs, there is also no clarity in terms of the ranking of officials within a state as that has been specified. A lot of the remarks have alluded to the fact that this is seemingly a problem. From a banking supervisor perspective, we don't necessarily concur with those remarks in the sense that in a framework of a risk-based approach, it is an institution's obligation to assess the risk that is posed to it. And so being too prescriptive in terms of who the ranking should be or should not be does not necessarily reconcile the concept that there should be an assessment to determine the risk posed by a particular individual and then to do the appropriate level of due diligence. Just to give a sense in terms of what our institutions currently do are and are in a position to be able to do, to be able to identify it, the regulations to the existing FIC Act prescribe a host of information that is mandatory that should be obtained on customers. We believe as a supervisor that the extent of that information in itself is enough to afford an institution with information that it should have at hand to determine if the customer is a PIP or not. Coming to the PIP definition, we accept that if you were to follow that approach, then some elements of that definition are currently, there's no means available, such as members related to a royal family or whether or not the person is a chairperson of an institution that has business affiliations or business relationship with government, etc. Many banks currently utilize automated tools like screening against databases that they procure from third-party data providers to be able to solicit information to enable them or supplement the customer onboarding information to assist in whether or not a customer is falling within the definition of a PIP. So for the most part, the mechanisms are there and the processes do exist at the moment which would enable institutions to be able to comply with these requirements. From a supervisory perspective, we expect that already our institutions have such processes and policies in place in order to be in a position to be ready for the requirements of the bill. If I move on to the provision which was also under contention earlier in the discussion related to keeping of records within the public, I think it's important that we place on record that the FARB has had discussions with Treasury in this regard, where Treasury has committed to revising this provision and replacing it with something that alludes more to accessibility of records. This reconciles and aligns to an existing guidance note which has been issued by the Reserve Bank Supervision Department, which already allows for outsourcing of certain functions and processes within the banking sector, which particularly affects the records of that institution. With regard to South African banks, whether it's a bank registered in South Africa that has operations in other countries, or whether it's a branch of a foreign bank that is licensed to operate in South Africa, either way, we find that there's a huge amount of cross-border arrangements and cross-border information sharing that is critical to a good governance, proper functioning of that institution for that information to share. And so such a provision would inhibit the processes of any institution to operate across border to function in an appropriate manner. Lastly, with relation to a risk management and compliance program within group, we agree with the provisions related to this. We think that the application of a FIC Act in an institutional group is an appropriate one, provided that it refers to a higher standard. Now, in terms of the Banks Act and regulations relating to banks, we have provisions in the law which require that where a bank has operations, offshore operations, that a condition of a banking license issued by the Register of Banks is that insofar as the provision of foreign legislation or the South African legislation, either of the two is higher, that the bank undertakes that it will implement the higher of the two standards. Now, some of the comments made earlier were that the proposed provisions of the bill in some respects are seemingly higher than what is expected in terms of the FATF requirements. That will allude to the fact that inadvertently or indirectly, the provisions of the FIC Amendment Bill, insofar as they deem to be higher, would extend to operations of South African banks in offshore jurisdictions, which may have unintended consequences. To some extent, we're cognizant of that as a banking regulator. However, I think in other respects, the requirement must be understood to mean that our expectation as a regulator refers to a reference to equivalence rather than equal. So if a foreign regulation requires due diligence to be done on theft and ours requires due diligence to be done on theft, we regard those to be as equivalent and not be pedantic to go down to the level of the definition to look at whether or not it's like for like. And so I think the proposed or seeming disadvantage that is put forth on the table is not really as much of a disadvantage concern if we look at it from a supervisory point of view. We just related to transitional arrangements, which is also such a sticky point that has come up a few times. We as a supervisor realize that the implementation of the provisions of the amendment bill will require significant improvement to existing systems and procedures. Particularly in the banking sector, this is extremely cost-intensive and resource-intensive, and it's time-consuming because of the volume both of customers and the volumes of transactions that are affected by these new provisions. We're cognizant of the fact that a transitional process will need to be developed, and we're open to that as a supervisor to enter into relevant and meaningful arrangements on an institutional. We think it's more appropriate that it be on an institutional level, because a small institution may come to a point that they are in a position to comply much sooner than larger institution may be. And so we think on a case-by-case basis, again assessing risk, it would be more prudent to have transitional processes and transitional arrangements that are relevant to particular institutions. That being said, There are fundamental provisions within this bill that we fall short of from an international obligations perspective, from an international standards perspective, and we put ourselves as a nation and as a country at risk in terms of how we perceive to either be open to money laundering and terrorist financing or to mitigate risk. And the more sooner we can implement as much of this bill as we can, the better off will be in terms of the effectiveness of our regime and how we regard it in the international arena. So from a SAR perspective, we really encourage as many institutions as possible to have as many of the measures as the bill provides for in place and effective and functioning sooner rather than later. And that's pretty much it. Thanks.
We've spoken to her, has actually made a written submission, but she hasn't informed us that she was coming. Have you got a copy of it? She didn't inform us that she was going to be here. So we said she can take us through a submission at once. Ms. Nyamani, is that right? You will take us through a submission next. Okay, after this one. Charles, can you go for it?
Thank you, sir, and all the best for 2016 to everyone here. Now, this morning when ASISA did their presentation, they noted that this particular piece of legislation does have an impact on tax-related issues, being the what we call CRS, the Common Reporting Standard, and the committee had a look at that last year, and the year before that, there was FATCA, the American Exchange Information Provisions. And the reason that's important, and I'm going to stick to the first three slides of this presentation because we are pressed for time, is we have a whole new world out there which deals with automatic exchange of information so that tax authorities around the world will be able to learn what is happening across the border with their residents in other countries. South Africa is what's known as an early adopter of the Common Reporting Standard, which means we are going to be starting this on the 1st of March 2016, so a month away. And one of the important points that speaks to the Common Reporting Standard is precisely the issue of beneficial ownership. Because at the moment it is far too easy just to put a company between yourself and the bank account, and then it becomes very difficult to see who is the real person behind the company. And so from our perspective, the changes that are being made with respect to beneficial ownership in the proposed bill are very welcome. Because if you go and look at the CRS, it says that when you do your work in terms of the CRS to determine who the controlling person is, which is the analogy for the beneficial owner, you must have regard to local legislation which implements anti-money laundering and know your client, and that presumes that your local legislation is FATF compliant, which ours isn't in this respect at the moment, but which it will be once this bill is passed. And so, from SARS's perspective, we are very glad to hear that the committee will be processing this bill as a package and that you're working to push, move it through the system as quickly as you can, because that will enable us to close this little gap that exists in terms of the Common Reporting Standard and ensure that we meet up with our international commitments with respect to that standard. So short, sweet, I hope it's reasonably complete.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. And the House at large. With the amendment of this Financial Intelligence Center Amendment Bill, it is amended before with the other sections like 27 of S 33 of the year 2004. But now with this one, I understand it wants us indicated that we should amend either the way of sentence, which is inverted commas, on the section, first section of this act. Now, what I've done, I've took up those sentences and the ways to add on them or expand on them. The first one is the definition of the administrative section. which it is in total verifies the act as a whole. It includes the action in line with the permission of the authority in terms of the support and approval according to the law. Also agreed by the authority the necessary sections concerning the plans obtained from various interrelated authorities as well as the public opinion, customs and influential persons that can bring encouragement on the opinion and practice. Aligned with the act of making legally authoritative binding agreement by ratifying and confirming them, like the day of the accountable institution sections were solemnly given to the great act, should be recorded as an important day. And the rewards be quoted to uplift the moral of the institution. The international law to be regulated by means of regulator sections. The inter-department actions of the nation like blockage, restrictions on the trade, withholding of loans intended to force obedience to be regulated under the FIT Act. That is the lawful action to be taken rather than to threaten with military action. That can show the consideration that least want to be to obey a rule, conduct or binding force. That is the rule of the nation between the nations. Then the use of oaths instead of the concise of not stealing from the society, instead support firm sanction of getting the consent from the government. And that cover up the section from the FIC into the country. Okay, the amendment of 45C, as it is, read the appeal continues, be extended by the traditional clause, additional clause, the applicant to be given a permission by the authority to extend the period through genuine and non-alternative reasons. The administrative section does not specify an individual and not have direct effect on one-to-one, therefore, a relevant provision be included on the sections from the various authorities and be confirmed by the National Review Fund body after be added to the administrative section. It should be confirmed first. And the definition of authorized officers is amended to expand the scope of the persons who may request information from the Financial Intelligence Center. In that sense, the sanctions must include those, some of them, which are added, the head of the service as being unique, for they differ from the sanctions of other service type, base, and type-wise, yet apply under the same law of the FIC and United Nations Act. Thus, the rules which are formulated within the country, honoring the act above, simplify the enforcement by the United Nations, which will have to find right and wrong country by country, as well as the National Commission, Director General on their capacity, practice as above to minimize the undignified practices by the categories, but promoting serious-minded persons who will learn and get need to abide by the laws. Most of them are concerned with the United Nations rules, but they are there, which are there for the country. The definition of barrier of negotiation instrument enables the transformation by avoiding contradiction between the state and beneficial owner and the legal person. However, the act of the approbation applied to the independent legal person should be included since the beneficial owner exercised the effective control on it. The contract shall encompass the proof and the acceptance of the duty done properly and formally. After the definition of center, the intention in section 1, client, means a person who has entered into a business relationship or a single transaction with an accountable institution. Now, the United Nations is to support the client, that is the state of the country, that is economically and politically dependent on the latter state. The country's internal policy to assist through its system in relation to the difficult conditions as relationships confronted them, it will be better to monitor the institution by means of analysis on the toleration of problems towards the trade. The statistics to be submitted to the FIC. The insertion of the sentences domestic prominent influential person as the definition of director means an individual who holds and as well include position for a period exceed 6 months or proceeding 12 months in the Republic. That is the rule of the Republic. The class of director should encompass the word directorship, who is his position or term of office, allowing to come down to give advice out of the people's experiences in the world. The appointed director to focus on the space where he is needed for the advice. That will promote the uniqueness of the institution of the finance. And the information collected by the domestic influential person nominated must be compared with that of the other country to form one clause. That will help to enhance the standard of the weak state operationally, as much as to discuss the information to the international organization based in the country. Like our president is very much influential. After the definition of entity, the definition of executive officer in relation to a company means a person who exercises general executive control and management responsible for the business and activities of the company, irrespective of any particular title given. He regularly participates to a material degree in that exercise of general executive control of a significant position, that is material degree physically. He has to participate physically. He has the power to put the laws into effect without approval, hence can issue the orders or directives granted by the Congress of the Constitution, as well as can get into agreement between the head and the government. He got the mandate to testify before a court or law, a court of law or a congressional committee, because he theoretically exercised executive privileges. She make it also do that. He has the power to turn the executive session of a legislative body, usually close to the public, in which he serves as a counsel that will help in considering the confirmation of the executive appointment after the adjournment of the Congress. Obviously, all this entitles him an executive chief, which gives him a power in the government or organization. The addition to foreign prominent public official under administrative sanction, he is a person appointed to an administration position, an executive in a corporation company of his country. He is a member of high rank above the lower in some honorary officials. He must be brief and indicated to officers the public utility in any state he is deployed to. I was explaining this with as the Act wanted to, thinking that it will be a pick up out of the information that is in here. Not all of every sentence that will make the law. Non-compliance. Amendment to make a distinction between what constitutes non-compliance, a taking an administrative action from non-compliance that is criminal section states as sorry.
Yamani, can I suggest? We've got a written text for you, right? If you said you wanted to speak to all of us, we will read this thing, they're going to summarize it tonight. Can you focus on the remaining key issues, please, a roundup in about 3-4 minutes, if you can, please? We've covered a lot of ground.
I must concentrate where... main points only. I shouldn't explain them. Okay. If the institution doesn't comply with the orders but grows from the opposition to get the restriction, that act does not attract an administrative restriction, yes, constitutes a non-compliance. But if it does not take an order delivered by the law, the act is on the criminal section side. if doesn't act in agreement with a request or command from the authority, that constitutes a non-compliance on the administrative section side. Risk management and compliance program. In FIC, is further detailed in clause 35. It is a risk to manage policy that can spark another country's program and be exposed to the staff members. Let me lump the whole information. Trust, in fact, in the FICA Act and as defined in the Trust Property Control Act number 57 or 1988, and include a trust established by the venture of court order and others. The FIC must have a provision of confident expectations that will keep the stock expectation into the business with other institutions. Have a central committee to control the product and prices of the commodity and resulted in resisting the competition through the illegal combination of businessmen or companies. And then amendment of the inflation lifts, the extension of the objective through training. Verification time. Setting out the procedures in respect of the financial section control measures specific to the notification of the person and entitled identity by the security control of the United Nations. In the procedure of the Act, the notification that should put amongst other states like this, the director of minister shouldn't carry the blame in terms of the application which is wrongly completed. Neither don't miss the notice advice. That is a total protection. The measures act of the FIC on guarantee the investor should be uniform, should be in a uniform method. To practice in one way, the method used for the similar faults be recognized by means of the same code. The money of the penalties to be paid in the national revenue funds could be recognized by separating it before it's sent into the revenue funds. The national revenue funds be divided into financial operations, sub-coffers, not coffers, that show where the money comes from, e.g. loans, credit, or from management officer. And the financer of the NRCB split differently to cover up all the categories of the defaulters. The examples are there. The further provision of offences, there must be a code of conduct to be inspected if it is complied with and if it qualifies the offence before the punishment is declared. If the accountable institution's obligations regard the due diligence record-keeping measures are over-applied, the inspection should be conducted to confirm the offence. Thank you.
Look at every line that you've written. Can we go to questions, please? Comments? What's happened? People are sliding. Maybe we have to be the lunch. Can we reduce the lunch? You can see now. Suddenly. And somebody said to me she's prepared to stay here till 9 p.m. and now I just say nothing. Her name shall not be mentioned. Sandy to the rescue, needless to say. Sandy wants to go quick. Have a day, Sophia.
I just need clarity on the revenue collected through sanctions. There's a suggestion that that money should compartmentalize and it should be stated that this comes from loans and so on. How do you administer that process? Is the suggestion that it goes straight to the extra revenue fund or it goes to SARS? Or I'm not clear on that.
Okay. What else? All right. No more questions, comments. Okay, come in. Now, Tracy, you'd like to respond to the issues that flew over from the previous session and here, right? Can you respond to Tandy's question?
Sure, I think I'll ask that.
That's not his question. It's not for me.
Sorry. Sorry.
Okay,
Tandy,
you respond.
Can I respond?
You respond, okay.
Okay, it does amended by saying the establishment of the National Refuel Fund is there to take the money which is collected. So it is not mentioned how should it go there. That's why I proposed that to show, not to make a confusion, the coffin should be divided into the coffers. The coffin, like when you pay the loan, there should be a coffer for the loan. By credit, there should be again. I think that way, it is in one institution or one country, then when they bring it together, they can make it free to go at the same time to the review fund body. Then the review fund body, it's the body which is under the FIC, Financial Intelligence Center, which is under the Act of United Nations. So if they collect it country by country, the country will also go into recognize their condition, their conditions actually, so that when tomorrow the United Nations wants to penalize a country, it has to compare it with other countries. And it will be easy that it will be knowing the exact conditions of the country of South Africa. They differ from the conditions of Kenya and Burundi and whatsoever.
Lifestyle, I don't know. Don't you agree with that? I think I understand the point she was making. Okay, excellent. So we move on then to responses, please,
National Treasury. Okay, thanks, Chair. Chair, I think I'll ask the team just to come in because I think we probably noted various questions. And Raymond will probably start with the one around the council, because I think there seems to be some kind of understanding of how that council was supposed to operate. So I think it will be useful just to clarify that role.
Thank you, Chair. I think the issue of the counter-money laundering advisory council has basically come up in a number of comments, even previously in some of the engagements we had with our stakeholders. And what appeared clear from those comments is that most of them reflected a bit of not a fuller understanding of how that council, operated, and in terms also of the purpose for which it was set up. If you look at the current act as it is, it does demonstrate that the main objective there was to basically advise the Minister of Finance in terms of how he exercises his authority over the operations of FIC in respect of what is indicated in the Act itself. Although there is one provision that relates to the Council operating as a platform for stakeholders to engage with the Centre. Our take and part of the reason for us to have moved it was a realization of the fact that it has not functioned the way we would have wanted it to be. And also, if you can even look at how prescriptive it is in terms of how the council are composed as well, it did not make its operation very effective. And as a result, I think it bordered on redundancy over time as well, and it did not really achieve the objectives very well. And it not only NGOs, but many representatives of industry, the way. So now we basically are removing it, but based through the consultations, what came up here is that we need to then find another mechanism that can work better. And yes, a consideration has been made to include provisions that are in the Financial Regulation Bill, which is basically the section 97-104, which we think is much more ideal. And we are considering the inclusion of that, obviously, with the necessary changes just to make it more appropriate for this particular bill. And that's one of the considerations we are making for these people. And I think that's what also the industry is happy to have, and we are open to that, Chair. Thanks.
Chair, I don't know if Pinta and Puventry would want to come in on some of their questions.
Thank you, Chair. I think just the other side of the point of this council's function that's probably not well understood. The council was not involved in the flow of information between the various government agencies. So the analysis and the information excuse me, that the FIC has prepared on particular investigations and shared with law enforcement agencies or with the revenue service, none of that happened through the facilitation of the council. That's an operational level structure that functions with, on an ongoing basis. And that's also why FICs participating in structures under the way the government is organized within the justice cluster, the economic cluster, and so on. Just one other point that was raised on central registries of beneficial ownership information. I think that's an important point to register, but not necessarily in the context of the amendments to the FIC Act. It is something that at a policy level South Africa is starting to understand and identify with. And why it was also included in the plan of action that South Africa submitted to the D20 as one of the avenues to pursue. But such a registry of beneficial ownership information is actually a much bigger animal that relates to how corporate institutions in South Africa are regulated, how the information about them are recorded, and how that information is made available. Not just for the purpose of the FIC Act, but for a much broader purpose, including revenue, including corruption, etc. But that is an issue that is being pursued as a policy initiative that will involve a number of different government departments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think from my side, just a quick one around the issue of risk-based versus rules. And I think it was quite interesting hearing from the Law Society the challenges which the bill might pose for small entities. And it's quite an interesting one because I got the impression that, you know, someone like a small law firm or entity might actually do better with minimum standard compliance vis-a-vis a full-blown risk-based approach. And I hear where the Banking Association is sort of coming from. If the mind shift is towards a risk-based approach, then that needs to be somehow reflected in the legislation. So I think maybe we should probably see how we can strike a balance, because for small entities, I think you might be served better by a minimum standard compliance. It is a bit of a tick box, but you know, you don't want to overburden your small entities. When you are more sophisticated entities, might actually be better off with the risk-based system. So I think it's acknowledging the tension between the two. So, thanks.
Okay. Stakeholders, we're going to close the public hearings and we're going to proceed on how we manage the next 24 hours. Do you want to say anything? 2 minutes for each of you. Do you want to say anything new or any response from your side to Trinity? Nobody. So you made a point. You want to hear from Parliament what we decide. Else, you're not from the public. Let's have the public first and then ask a question. All right. Quickly. Yes, go ahead, Tasa.
Yes, Chair. Just the final submission. Sorry, you caught me as I was munching on what I'm speaking.
Sorry, I thought it was just that.
At times we feel that both, obviously you wouldn't expect it of this committee, but certainly our regulator, in this case being the FIC, sometimes doesn't quite understand our industry and how we operate. I made a point about the movie casino, with due respect, most of them see still wear that cap. They think of us and think of the movie casino. A few years back. Correct, but still that mentality is still there. And despite numerous invitations, at some stage Treasury did take us on, and it was at a time where there was a proposal to have the 15% holding tax. And we took them through and explained to them how impractical it was in terms of just how to run the games. Sadly, the FIC has, despite numerous offers, have never taken us on it, which is sad because it would give a perspective of how a casino is operated and the controls that are there, so that whatever intervention is necessary is then based on that understanding. You know, because quite honestly, is we made a point about in the seeking fast pace in our TV, and I'll just briefly, I'll just say 2 minutes. You know, if we, some of the requirements, especially when there seems clear there's, from a legislative point of view, there's confusion as to whether the FIC wants to help us have a risk-based approach or have a rule-based approach. It seems like the hope is we're having a risk-based approach, but in fact we're having a rule-based approach in terms of what comes out of the legislation because of the minimum, all sorts of requirements that are being prescribed. But in a practical example of a gambling table, a blackjack table, so as an example, where you have 30 players playing, some are seated and some are standing, and if you have to record details of each and every bet, it means that game, just to place the bets, will be another 10 minutes before you, because you need to collect name and surname of every person. Then you need to say how much are you betting, and then you spin, or you dish out the cards. Then you spend another 10 minutes recording who won what. And then you know, this process goes on and on. So it means that in any hour, you end up with being sort of, what, five games? Two or three games. And that is the whole purpose of running that business, because then one, it cannot be attributed to anyone playing. Imagine if you're playing a game and you have those start and stops, which is why our argument has always been, it's start about what you bring in, what you bring out. Can you record it? Can you give us comfort that this is what you, or this is what you can record? And that, in that case, it makes, as opposed to try and have, which is what they seem to be coming out very strongly. We want to know each and every bet and each and every outcome of a particular game, as opposed to a gaming session. So for us, I think we still want to have that interaction where we could take our regulator through that process so that they can understand, like we said, you would not have a gambling business if you're going to have two or three games in an hour. It will not be profitable. And more so when, unlike banks, where it's almost like thou shalt have a bank account, people don't have to gamble. It's not an obligation to anyone. It's a form of entertainment. So if it's going to be made ridiculously impossible to play, then people are just going to go elsewhere, watch movies, visit teasers and everything else, but certainly not come to do a casino environment for entertainment. And practically, so either we must then decide, unless we say we do not want this industry, then we'll have the kind of purpose that we have. Lastly, Chair, internationally, even with the Macau scenario, where there's been a lot of third-party pay and junkets, and when the Chinese government turned down on them, the revenue soared. They've just been going down quarter on quarter, and I think it's been going on for 18 months and what have you. Even with that, FATF comes up with the international standards. It recognizes that, unfortunately, certain transactions, you must just have some sort of a threshold. And introduces, I think the threshold is about $3,000. South African regulator thinks that is not wise, and we still have the losses to try and understand how could you come to that conclusion, even with that environment, which is not even any close to what we have in South Africa, in Saudi Arabia, or elsewhere. So I think the plea really is, please, can we understand what we're regulating in that environment, categorize properly as being a form of entertainment, whilst balancing it with the need to make sure that there is no money laundering taking place. We always had these rules. We had to have them long before they had the FIC legislation. So can we just sit down and talk about the practicalities? Because it's nice to pass laws, but if you're not going to implement them, we either going to collapse the industry, or we're just going to waste a lot of resources in and out of the course of this country. That is just my key. Thank you.
Thing, this movie you referred to is a US-based movie, right? Casinos to symbolize American culture. I just ask you, what happens there? Have they got less onerous requirements than you've been asked to observe in this country?
To be honest, I maintain, and it's my story, and I'm sticking to it. The only reason why you had another revision of The only reason why we had the latest revision in terms of the factors and recommendations was precisely because it was a bit loose in Macau, it was a bit loose in the US. In fact, the US regulators only really moved in on trying to do anything about it last year, quite side on a serial that kicked the ball, suppose. We had already learned from what they were doing when we implemented our legislation in 2004. So we were very far ahead in terms of what we were doing. So I think we still need a pack.
What the FATF requires and what you've been required to do in this book, are you trying to say it's more onerous than what the FATF says? Should be done.
For example, I think that most of what FATF says is probably we can live with. But it becomes problematic when even our regulator thinks what FATF says is essentially not even a standard. The standard is too low. And for example, I gave an example of those exemptions where they grant an exemption of $1,000 for certain transactions. We think that's not wise. The certain things I think that we do over and above standard, because like I said, is if you recall gambling in this country, it had to be a self-regulatory model because it was in the homeland in the past, and it wasn't in South Africa. And in any event, shareholders always want to protect their money and what happens there. So they had to have all these rules to make sure that they can account properly for the revenues and account properly for the profits.
Okay. Can I suggest something? You will reply tomorrow, right? But members, can you apply your mind to this? What I'm suggesting is I can see nothing obvious to what you're saying. Needless to say, National Treasury and FIC will have their responses. They probably won't agree with you. Now, Parliament can't prescribe to you to meet them. I don't want to do that on members who apply their mind. I would prefer, but I would like to tell the majority with me, they can think about it, but actually you do meet them. They are a specific industry. Whatever is the reservations members have about casinos in your industry, you have been prescribed for by this post-party democracy from the right thing. So either the government, the parliament, and the public decide they don't want you, or they want you. When they want you, they also have to listen to the tones of your industry and how you work. So can I suggest that let us think about it? Tomorrow we'll decide whether we are Treasury, FIC, to meet with you, and within what time frame. So. But presumably the intention cannot be. Obviously making it a bit unrealistic as a reason that within every hour so many minutes will get lost in filling in forms. It sounds utterly absurd. I don't think that would be the intention. Unless you script some one of these unrealistic novels. But it sounds in English language very carcass. If I say so. I don't think that's the intention. So we can find some at least compromises. Now, time's running out. If anybody wants anything new apart from CASA? Yeah. So Alf, you're not a member of the stakeholders, but you can speak here. So go for it because they don't seem to be wanting to say anything, and Tandy, and then we round up and start on process.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick thing. France said to me at lunchtime, you're probably wondering what I'm doing here, and I said, no, I'm sure you've got good reason to be here. And then I've listened to what he has said, and it's just been sinking in slowly. Why would SARS want to know beneficial ownership? Are we going to try and transfer tax liability? I'm just trying to work out why beneficial ownership is so important to SARS. And Stephen, then the other point is that this kind of parallel negotiations that are happening between stakeholders and National Treasury, and Alano is saying, yes, I think that's a good idea. I'm not sure how that comes back into the bill, quite honestly. Are we going to be asked to make amendments to the bill on behalf of National Treasury? And obviously we'll decide whether we were going to do that or not, but on recommendation. Okay, thanks. Yeah, and I'm over 60 and my memory is very short now.
Chair, I was just reminding you that earlier on I made a request that the stakeholders must make recommendations in relation to transitional arrangements, because in all fairness, when we're talking about whether we're taking a risk-based approach or not, it's more about how are we going to ensure compliance. So this is a matter of making a suggestion, a case-by-case, so that it can be taken into account moving forward. So it also applies to the sort of thing.
Okay. Then we're done with the public hearing. You can stay if you want to. We're going to discuss where we go from here. I had a brief meeting with the National Treasury FIC and our parliamentary team. Now, what we're suggesting is, instead of sitting, the only issue that we would like a bit more discussion about now is whether or not we separate the spot. You go through it again clearly, maybe for 5 minutes, and you come back with an answer. I get the sense that the majority of us, and people can put their hand up, is moving towards saying, we'll take a final decision in the next 24 hours, I'll consult Parliament House be that it's probably better on the whole that you go ahead with this bill, with the understanding that you're not likely both houses to have passed this bill and the President promulgated it by the 26th of February. But that you do so in a way that communicates to the court that you respect the decision, and for a variety of reasons spell out, and if necessary, the committee can agree to write a letter to support that. And Chris Jenkins will guide us on that. But they make it very clear that this committee will work expeditiously on this bill, and that we will seek to finish it by the middle of March, come what may. But when I've done it currently, we will seek to achieve so that the bill is finalized, and if need, we can bring the NCMP in, the committee in earlier, we can negotiate, it won't be hard, so it can sit in. So that we try to finish the bill by the 1st of May. That means we also approach the President and say, can you look at this bill quickly and promulgate it, right? So you're losing, as we said, am I correct? March, April, about 2 months. But in regard to that, can you add to what you said? What would be the problem if we opt for that route? That we process the bill at one go up to the 1st of May.
I don't want to add, does your lawyer want to add, does Advocate Jenkins want to add?
So, Chair, from our side, I think we would be comfortable with that approach. And I think that's also
so
our...
Just go through quickly again, what was the court decision? Can the lawyer ask, what is the court decision? And what would be the practical effect of doing what we're seeking to do at the moment?
Chairperson, the Constitutional Court confirmed the decision of the High Court, which found Section 45 to be unconstitutional but only to a certain extent. And that's the thing that it allows, and I'll ask you to add if you want to. In searches for criminal activity or searches of premises, of private premises, which was a particular issue in this case, they found that unconstitutional, and the Constitutional Court confirmed that judgment, and then they read into that provision for a period of 2 years, a warrant provision in certain circumstances. But it didn't sound that the FIC and supervisory bodies can still continue with routine inspections for compliance purposes only. So that can still continue from 27 February if there's no change to the law by then. It's only that if there's, they want to end a private residence, they will need a warrant, and if necessary, the Criminal Procedure Act would be used, but that will be a proper search and seizure process, and they can approach the court or a magistrate or a judge or for a warrant. That's why we thought it's not a transitional, or we said it's not a transitional, it's a bit on the
I think the important point from our perspective is that this decision of the Constitutional Court was to allow a dispensation for us to continue work as other supervisors like the Reserve Bank and FSD and so on, while the 2 year period was given for the amendment to the legislation. So it wasn't in order to amend the legislation. It was a reading in that the court made so that we can continue work within the circumstances that the court provided for while the legislation is being amended. Where this deadline now passes, that reading in expires and it disappears. So that reading clause that the Constitutional Court provided us with then disappears. We can no longer make use of it. And therefore, the impact on our work is as NPF explained. We will then only be able to do certain types of inspections, not the inspections that were now allowed under this reading in provision of the Constitutional Court. That does not have a major impact on our work. Our work doesn't come to a standstill because of that, because we can still continue with normal routine work where we have the consent of the inspected party and they don't object to the inspection, and we're not looking at private residences and things like that to inspect.
You can, at the moment, go into a private home until the court decided otherwise, without a warrant. on the suspicion that there's some wrongdoing, and you want to find evidence for it. Now you can, with this thing lapsing on the 27th of February, you could still go to a person's home, but you need the ordinary warrant for any criminal suspicion that a judge or a magistrate would issue. So you can still do it. The difference is that you now will need a warrant for it. Is that right?
That's
you can still go to a private room and get a warrant.
But then we have to convince a magistrate that there's criminal activity happening there.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't use the FRC Act provisions to that.
In normal circumstances, what happens? Does the magistrate or judge decide relatively quickly?
Yes, no. Okay, yes. In terms of the normal Criminal Procedure Act provisions, yes. I mean, you can get that warrant. And if... That's correct, yes. Yeah, like I say, it doesn't impact our normal day-to-day work. This is really exceptional circumstances where we would want to do an inspection of this kind where we would require a warrant.
You will also need now to get a warrant from a judge or magistrate, or institutions you can continue to use the act as it was.
For institutions, let's say for instance a bank, we can continue without a warrant, provided that it's a normal routine inspection. It's not to go and look for something specifically wrong. And even if you want to look for something specifically wrong, if the institution consents to the inspection, then you can still proceed without a warrant. Otherwise, you have to get a warrant. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Sorry, you want to come in? Yeah, that's what I was thinking about, yeah. Yeah, why is it in the first instance? Why do you need it in the first place? Why do you put it in the original act? Yeah. All right, I was thinking of a reverse question. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. Let's take the other, I'll come back. Why did you put it there in the first place? If you don't have it, is it really a problem? I think that's what you're saying. Now, I've got a reverse question before I forget it. I can't just forget it. Which is, I was wondering in 2 months, will people do all sorts of things knowing that you can't just walk? I don't see that happening, but I should ask this question.
No.
I don't know what really happens in the underworld, right? I mean, I watch Law and Order and all these things. So I bet any, if one tenth of what happens on the TV screen, they need to go by. The criminals would use these 2 months maybe to do all those things. Okay, then it's David and Tandy.
Chair, I mean, you are probing the operational consequences, and I'd like to hear the responses. I think it would also be useful for the committee to hear from Advocate Jenkins what the consequences or possible effect would be of Parliament not complying with what I presume, and I might be incorrect, is a deadline set by the Constitutional Court. Okay. I have very high regard for the Constitutional Court.
We who provided for this speech. We who, from a national democratic tradition, believe that Parliament is supreme, not 10 appointed people, right? Who decide to make a compromise. So, let's go on.
It's a good thing you're not on Twitter.
I will remind you of the discussions that took place before we rose on the fifth floor when we were voting on schedules. Some of the members who are here today and asking questions were not there on that day. And it relates to why in particular you needed to have this clause. And I asked certain questions. And I just want to refresh you on some of the things I asked. I asked whether an element of surprise is not going to be lost in this context. Two, I also raised the fact that other businesses operate from private residences, not from offices. But I also said that what we know that there are certain cases where false warrants were obtained to pursue people in a very, which English word can I use, in a very unconventional manner, which has led to the Constitutional Court to take a decision of this nature. But for you to come and do seizure in a household, you must have relevant documentation. You should have done your investigation properly so that it must not be seen as a witch hunt. So I do not want a situation where we go back and want to delete that important clause of surprise where criminal activity has moved away from offices to households and they are there. But to say let it be done in a constitutional, professional manner, but to continue. So I think in principle on that day we agreed. We were saying let's be constitutional, let it be done properly, let the procedures be followed, because there will be criminals who move away from offices and conduct their operations in their households, and we want not to be surprised in any way by investigators, but we're saying investigators must go the research warrant. They must have obtained the right to seize whether it's documentation or digital equipment or any other form of information that will assist them in the investigation. We agree in principle, but if we are reversing, then let's open up discussions again.
The thing is that we are now having heard people. There's no such thing. We agreed. We always see, and I say tentatively, this is my view, this is our view. As we hear more people, we will change our views as a majority. Personally, I like the thing that you had in the original book. I think surprise element is crucial. And given the amount of leaks that occur in the criminal justice system, right? I read, for example, yesterday, there's a Jewish rabbi wanted for child molestation and so on. And the police, every time they go to the hotel, they really disappear. The wonderful interpretation by Spocky followers, who say the man sits there, and the police see every room, but they don't see him. He reads peacefully from the equivalent of the Bible, what is it? And God is protecting him. Because every time the police comes, he's not running away. He sits there. They will check Mankosi, he looks suspicious. David looks more suspicious. Kazi looks too young, they know her. But the guy is standing there forever. They say every time the police came, he was there, but they couldn't recognize him because God provided a veil, right? So you are free to think what you want. I prefer to think, as the police spokesperson says, that they think they leak every time. I don't know if he's guilty or not, but men must go and face these charges in Israel for child molestation and so on, right? So what I'm saying is there's too many leaks. So I like the thing, but hey, the majority will decide. Okay. So, Advocate Jenkins, what is, under the circumstances, your current tentative cursory consideration of the matter until you come back to us? Because you see, colleagues, we have to decide by tomorrow so that we orient our program around what decision we take. Our David's listening. So basically, we say to you, based on what you heard today, do you think it's reasonable to write an appropriate letter to court? The Parliament has to do it, but I think the executive should approach them because you came to out of this bill so late. But Parliament understands the circumstances and would prefer, though it has an option of doing that. The fact that the court can give us, like the executive, 2 years more implies they do not see a fundamental problem with the original act if it's sorted out. That's a presumption I can make. But go ahead, Mr. Jenkins. Advocate Jenkins.
Thank you, Chairperson, and honourable members and guests and colleagues. I think, Chair, what one needs to understand is the reason the Constitutional Court agreed with the High Court to strike down that provision in the FICA Act was because it was, according to its analysis, an infringement of your privacy, amongst others, the dignity involved and so on, but let's just keep on privacy. So it was entering a private home without a warrant. And therefore, it made an order to say you cannot do that, but because we know that you have certain... We have to strike a balance as a court. We have to strike a balance between those individual rights and the government's purpose to prevent crime. So let's give an order, and therefore it made order. It didn't keep the unconstitutional provision in place. It, as was said by Mr. Trent, it read in a provision there to say, yes, you can enter private premises on warrant. Without a warrant, you cannot enter private premises unless, and it broke an exception. It says that And there's an important part because the FICA acted as inspectors. They're not from the South African Police Service, which is controlled by another piece of legislation. It says that an inspector can enter without a warrant if the warrant, if obtaining the warrant would actually eliminate that element of surprise and you have reasonable suspicion that there is a crime being committed. So I think that's covered. That issue that was raised by the committee is covered. So if this provision then falls down on the 27th of February, that won't be there. What the Treasury will have to do, or the inspector, they will have to then go with a SAPS member who can still do that in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act. So it's still there. We're not going to leave a vacuum. Whether you take a foot back or a step back in the race against crime and whether it will be exploited, that's probably some speculation that can go in there. I don't know what will happen, but it's only for a few weeks. The issue that I think I need to address you on is, what is Parliament's role in trying to meet that deadline? Now, first of all, in this court, we were not a party. One can write to the Chief Justice. I would assume the Speaker should write in terms of protocol to the Chief Justice, but it is not really the way you communicate with the court. Courts communicate through affidavits and through directives issued by the Chief Justice. So my view, and it was also my view in a precedent we had at the beginning of last year with the Performing Animals Act, the department or the person involved with the court, they should go and explain why we should extend that deadline. And the court will have one cogent reasons, proper reasons for that. And we'll have to submit an affidavit and go to court and ask them to extend it. I don't think there will be much problem extending it simply because the seriousness of that infringement of the personal right has been taken away by the court. Because there's only very limited circumstances which you can enter a private residence without a warrant in its reading in provision. So the court might say, look, it's fine, carry on, we'll extend it. If National Treasury is of the view that it's not necessary, well, then that's their view. I do not think, and I say this as you allowed me to, my initial thoughts, Parliament has a role to play to approach the court, and we, in a metaphorical, we need to make fire under the National Treasury to hold them to account in terms of the Constitution, to say, we will hold you to account if your view turns out to damage the national interests of South Africa. We will hold to account for that. Someone will have to explain, because we've raised this in the committee. Parliament has raised it. So we do not want to lose that element of surprise to combat crime. So, Chair, lastly, the issue of respect for the Constitutional Court. I do not think it plays a role here, simply because it's not an order to do something. It is a, by a certain date, you have to do that, and you don't. If you do not do that, further rights will be infringed. Simply said, we will need to offer a national treasury. If you want this power, we will circumscribe the power a little bit to be in line with the Constitution. And if you fail to bring your bill to Parliament or convince the President to sign it in time, it will fall away, and then you'll have to make your own plans under the Criminal Procedure Act. So that's my initial view.
I think we should make something clear. We, based on what David just said, ask you to clarify. On previous occasions, I know that the Constitutional Court's approach for an extension, my understanding it was that it's the executive, not Parliament, at that time. We never actually approached the Constitutional Court for an extension of a deadline. We haven't. Is that right? Or have we?
We have when they found the Financial Matters of Parliament Act unconstitutional. And then we went to get an extension to bring the provinces.
Yes. The next thing I want to say then is, personally, I think, common colleagues, we should not have a situation where the executive seeks an extension. That's not what we're asking for. Based on David, we said, it's just information. But if that's not something that's a done thing, then the minister doesn't have to write. But I think the minister should write to the Chief Justice and say, given that we presented the bill so late, and more importantly, there are a whole lot of other amendments in the bill, informing that it will not meet the deadline, but will probably be done by the 1st of May. Probably or something. I can speak to the minister about this, but what I want to say is, what we don't want is the executive saying, give us a 3-month extension, and then Parliament, for some reason beyond our control, as often happens, we suddenly lock Thursday because the people want Thursday. We suddenly lock the 16th because the World Bank is turning up. So these things happen. So I'd like to say that we don't actually propose they must seek extension of time. It's a credit to informing the court. Having said that, I would like to suggest members that we don't want to end this discussion with the first item tomorrow, because until we're clear about this, we're not going to know exactly how to structure our program. What we can do anyway as a tentative thing is to deal with that clause first. So we pass it and park it off, and then I speak to the chief cook. I'll be with him all day on Thursday, all day on Friday. There'll be plenty of time to meet him. President Bengo will be there. I'll be there all day on Thursday, all day on Friday. I can brief him. The deputy speaker will be there. The deputy speaker will be there. I'll brief him. I've got all day on Thursday, all day on Friday. So things are done. For the chief of the take two, the speaker. Just alert her. And the leader of government business, I'll inform her. How about that? So unless we get an overwhelming argument, tomorrow, we're going to take the decision to proceed as a one vote and first of May deadline. I'll speak to Charles today. And then what we will do is, Erica Jenkins, you will draft in our report to Parliament. This expression of mine, you can do it now for us in the next 48 hours. I can't speak with Tamir. Then if we discover something that's unforeseen, that none of the brilliant people here are, starting with Gandhi, say, also, then we will have a Gandhi, who had agreed in principle last November, long before Turkey decided. Why did you see it? Okay, that's done. Let's deal with process issues. Basically, as we're coming tomorrow and dealing with that clause, anyway, park it off, right, the first clause. Then what you're going to do is we need to release that. That's what we're suggesting. Don't sit in here for another half an hour. Then let's get going. So when I see your friend there, yes, right, Brandon. So what I would suggest is we meet now and we split things up into different things that we're thinking about. But we're suggesting, colleagues, that because of time constraints and these endless bills that are coming, what we're going to do tomorrow is sit at 4 o'clock. And what we're going to do is we're going to start at 10 with the policy issues. And we're going to discuss them. Any of you who can be here tomorrow, you've got all three of you, one of you can stay. I think in charge of your administration fees in your bank, you know, we gave you lunch as well, hopefully. You can check within 1 to 2, we gave you lunch. We sacrificed it, we're going to reduce our lunch for the next few days. Guess who's here to get chopped off? So I would like to suggest, Ellen, you speak to them. When they're here to stay all day and also fund. They're not corrupting things, just food for themselves. Because Parliament can't accuse of corruption because we have a small budget. So they can have good food. We will show them that by leading the country in this difficulty that we will have our little teas and coffees and one drumstick each, right? And one carrot each, right? That's what we're going to have for tomorrow, right? So we're suffering to make the bourgeois enjoy this day in Holland. Now, what I'm suggesting is at least the first 10 to 12 dollars, we have them ready. Don't worry, we're waiting for you. We are doing our initiative. We're going to look at line by line where the commas are in the right place. But on content issues, I think we will send the bill back to you once we've got relative consensus on it. We move and you can comment. It's not only getting invited to Parliament all the time. We'll set up a subcommittee. We'll sit with you. We'll do teleconferences. We've got access to your teleconference, right? So the committee can meet there. You don't reply in. This time we're controlling things. We can ask you precise questions. No long speeches. Right? So that's just why you're unhappy with the amendments we made. We're going to tell you, that's it, closure, we finish the problem. Which of the proposals I've just offered people are unhappy with? Okay. And the final, please, Dave, don't give us a hard time. Let us do what we've made. Do some work. For example, you are away. We've got some steps for Africa highlights. We'd like you to summarize this. This is practice. How many times have I, you know, the constitutional court at all, there's a lawyer here. You know the lawyer, David? Don't pretend to be a lawyer. Okay. And don't go to South Wim, Griffin Grove and all those lawyers. Save the money because you're going to lose the elections, betting you in the metros, you need the money. Thank you all for your time, and we shall see you when we see you. Hopefully not before.